Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. It is a Thursday morning. It's the 3rd of June, and we couldn't be more delighted to be in your company. We're glad that you are in ours. If you'd like to be a part of said conversation, all you have to do is write us a note. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you this morning, and we'll get started with the news of the day. Alan Shartok is in the house. Good morning, Alan. Fresh from a taping of the Media Project. How goes it?
Present. I'm voting present.
You're voting present. All right, good.
That's what they do in the legislature. They don't want to vote, so they say present.
That's good. I understand. So no comment on the taping of the Media Project, which leads me then.
The Media Project, as always, was very good. Three of them arguing that the federal coffers should be used to support newspapers. And I say not until the publishers— I'll give you a preview here. Not until the publishers relinquish their office and make those newspapers into not-for-profits.
Well, it didn't exactly go down like that. But the three of us, I believe, are willing begrudgingly to accept federal money, but we really don't want it. We don't need it. We'd rather not need it. But we're in survival mode.
I got to get the wax out of my ears because I could swear that's what I was hearing.
Well, go to Mitch McConnell and get turtle wax.
Yes. There.
Simon and
I see what you did there. I like that. Well, good morning. The other voice you're hearing is publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, our good friend, Ira Fussfeld. Good morning, Ira. How are you?
Good morning. Very nice to be here.
Always good to have you here, and you're in the studio, and this is so weird and good, and I know I keep saying that, and I apologize if I annoy our listeners by the novelty of having everybody here, but where it's like, you know, that first week of school where you're meeting everybody again and seeing and getting into your normal routine, and so our various iterations of the panel have come together. For example, this is the first time that Vera Acarius Kelly has been in the studio since we started this up a week ago. She is Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics. Good morning, Vera.
Good morning, Joe, Ira, and everyone on the panel. It's so exciting to be in the same space as members of the roundtable.
Well, we can see each other. We know when we're talking.
But your analogy about school is accurate, except you extend it a little bit by saying by the third week, you just can't wait to get out of there and you don't want to see anybody anymore.
Yeah, no, that's true. No, that's very true. Also, we welcome, and via our old technology, and when I mean old technology, I mean what we did like a week ago, Dorsey Appliers is with us, Albany's chief city auditor. Good morning, Dorsey. How are you?
Good morning, Joe, and all. I am doing very well. And although I'm not there physically, I am there in spirit, but happy to be here.
Well, we're thrilled that you are there and with us, and that is what counts, and we thank you very much for doing that. All right, that is our group this morning. Again, if you would like to join us, all you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So let's go to the big story, I think, of the day, and that is the fragile coalition to oust Netanyahu faces growing pressure. Benjamin Netanyahu, the longest-serving prime minister in Israeli history, was close to being knocked out of power for the first time in 12 years. And that was, when I went to bed, was the headline I was dealing with. But now, Mr. Netanyahu has signaled that he would not go down without a struggle. The agreement to replace Netanyahu with Naftali Bennett is still up in the air. That vote, I believe, still expected to happen between 7 and 12 days from now. And again, I think the word, which even was used when it seemed to be a bit more apparent, was the word fragile, a fragile coalition. So, Alan, your thoughts?
Well, it has to be fragile, and the moment that Netanyahu disappears from the scene, you're going to see verbal combat, over there. And of course, there is this relationship between Trump and Netanyahu. They are, in my mind, the same guy, probably separated at birth. And, you know, I'm fascinated by the fact that in a not-so-subtle way, Netanyahu is calling on all of those people who have to go along with this, who are in those coalition partners, to reject the deal, and basically signaling that he's going to go after individuals in each of those places who, like American politicians, aren't going to want to lose their meal ticket.
Vera.
Well, I think it's going to be fascinating because this is parliamentary politics 101 here that we're going to watch. Because, first of all, the Knesset has to vote this new coalition into parliament and affirm the ultra-nationalist Naftali Bennett in this coalition. But what's interesting is that the speaker is a member of the Likud party, a member, a supporter of Netanyahu, and he will try and expand the time period when this vote actually happens by as long as almost 2 weeks. So now Netanyahu, who's an incredibly talented, rough and tumble politician, will try to come up with any option and angle to blow this eight-party coalition apart. It won't be that difficult in a sense because those parties are so broad a coalition and they have no overlap on the Israeli-Arab-Palestinian negotiation process. What they have agreed to is only talk about infrastructure and economic policy, but nothing that is highly controversial so far. And that's the angle that Netanyahu and his party will use to try and bombard this coalition and blow it apart and try to pursue some kind of opportunity to reassemble a coalition himself. Now, the problem with him is that he has not been loyal to his own former, you know, coalition partners and has always preferred to save himself and strengthen his own power position. So this is going to be a super interesting Game of Thrones we're seeing here.
Okay, so our Red Wedding aside, are you thinking that if you had to prognosticate, what do you think is going to come of this?
There's a 50-50 chance here that I see for Netanyahu to remain. If he successfully goes after either the hard right or the hard left by creating a rift between the two extremes that are now in this coalition, if he manages to split off some of them, then the eight-party coalition isn't strong enough.
Well, it seems to me that Alan had a point about Netanyahu's relationship with Trump. I think he Netanyahu, has gone to school on Trump, and rhetorically and perhaps in action is going to it's going to all seem very familiar what's going to happen there as opposed to what's happened here. I wish I could tell you I know this very well, but I what I thought I read was that the would-be prime minister is farther to the right than is Netanyahu.
Well, by far,
That makes me wonder. Well, why? And because it's also my impression that one of the reasons that Netanyahu's position had become tenuous is that he was losing the support of his people who wanted him to become more moderate, particularly the younger people wanted him to become more moderate. So I'm not sure how the coalition, I think you use the word fragile. If not, I'll use it. I just don't know how it can stay together with the kind of diversity in political philosophy that exists there.
So the whole, what they all agree on is they want to get rid of Netanyahu, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the key.
That's the key. The only thing they got.
Because Netanyahu is accused of having committed a series of corruption-related and bribery-related crimes. So he's, you know, defended, the famous defendant number one in court, and they are simply all tired of his power-grabbing conduct. And so they're using all kinds of mechanisms to now push him out of politics so he can finally face the indictments from 2019.
Dorsey, I promise I'll get you in this conversation in a second. I just want one more for Vera. We asked this question earlier in the week, and I'll ask it of you. How much do you think the violence of the last 2 weeks has played into this coalition?
Well, what's interesting is that a lot of people made the assumption that the violence actually benefited Netanyahu because he could unite the Israeli voting public, you know, behind him and position himself as the defender of the homeland against the attack from Hamas. However, what has happened is that this was an opportunity that also created an opening to other parties on the left and right to say, we have had Netanyahu for 12 years. Isn't it time to try a different ticket? Because things are getting worse. Nothing is resolved. We need to have more of a coalition arrangement to represent all of Israel or the majority of Israelis, rather than every 6 to 8 months have a new election that doesn't resolve in a satisfactory outcome. So it actually has weakened Netanyahu, despite the fact that people assumed it might be the opposite. So what we see now is an effort to bring a unified coalition front forward in Israel. And, Bennett will be, if he is confirmed, only be prime minister for 2 years. The next prime minister that's in the deal is the secular, more moderate Israeli coalition. So they already worked out double prime ministerships.
Alan?
If they get that far, as you may remember, the last time around, Netanyahu promised power sharing also, and we never quite got there. And really, it is so unlikely that these people won't start to fight with each other that it's hard to believe it's going to be anything like a long-term arrangement.
Yeah, king for a day. Dorsey,
exactly.
Your thoughts?
So, you know, my thoughts are similar to what has already been said. So I'll just reinforce a few points. You know, we can't forget the backdrop here. We, across the world, just witnessed a lot of bloodshed, people on the ground devastated by the fighting that was happening. And so that's the backdrop. And this situation, although multi-layered, it reminds me of this quote that I love, and it's, through chaos, there is opportunity. And as was already mentioned, this coalition, in the midst of all of this chaos, between the bloodshed, the corruption, sees this moment of opportunity. And I think some are putting the cart before the horse, talking about the coalition and the dysfunction that people project because their views are so vastly different. But this coalition, going back to why it was formed in the first place, their primary function in this moment in time is to get Netanyahu out of his leadership position. And they seem to be working that angle very well at this moment and are positioned to accomplish that goal. The last point that I'll make, and Alan mentioned this in some and other panelists, if you look at the dynamics that played out in the U.S. election and what's happening now, there are some similarities here. And I want to be very sensitive to point out that not identical, but chaos, which led to opportunity for a change in administration, but also the figurehead. If you look at Trump and what people have said about him, those who really wanted him out of office, you look at the Netanyahu and what people have said about him and why they want him out of office, very similar. Leadership that believes they put themselves over the people. There are some serious character flaws and character issues. They're very volatile. They have burned various bridges when it comes to their allies. And so this notion of loyalty, they just don't get that. They don't understand it. They don't operate from that. And then lastly, you know, two figures who are motivated by power and are reckless with yielding that power. And so I think, you know, while, you know, of course he will be fighting tooth and nail to maintain that power, his track record has shown people who he will attempt to bring back in his corner that it's smoke and mirrors. No matter what he says, he will do what he wants to do, and he does not recognize this notion of playing fair and being loyal to allies.
We have to pause there, and we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We also welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we will get to the letters in just a moment. Alan Chartok, Dorcia Pleers, Ira Fussfeld, and Vera Akarius-Kelly all joining us this morning on the panel. All you have to do to join us is to write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll continue our conversation after news from the BBC.
Run, Red Fox, run. Run, Red Fox, run.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Dorcia Pleers, and Vera Karius-Kelly. We welcome you and your letters and your input, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. And we would love to have you be with us. So let's see. This from Bill. Yesterday morning, I had the radio on but was doing something else, and I was only half listening when I thought I heard the news reporter say that Tony Bennett is going to be the new prime minister of Israel. No.
He left his heart in San Francisco.
different Bennett. Different Bennett. The other question is, let's see. I lost the letter. Okay. I thought I had another letter here that was of import, but it
well,
was
I'll
not.
Ask a question.
Okay,
if in fact the coalition becomes more tenuous than the optimists would like it to be, does that not put Israel the state in more jeopardy from its neighbors? In other words, if the neighbors who are out to get Israel sense and can see real strife within Israel, will they feel this is the good time to pounce?
On the other hand, Ira, my bet is that one of the reasons that the Israeli Arab Party is joining the coalition is everybody wants to see Netanyahu out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, it's true. I mean, I don't give any hope at all to this thing lasting for any great amount of time, but I do think everybody stands to gain who wants Netanyahu out of there.
And this was another question that I had that we had raised earlier in the week in discussing this, which is the idea this coalition came together instead of holding yet another election,
right?
You know, another fourth election. So even if this coalition stands, how long before that rears its head again, do you think?
Well, I mean,
well,
yeah, go ahead,
no,
Alan.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No,
no
I mean,
well,
you go.
Yeah, go ahead. Please. No, you go ahead.
Just on.
So,
fun.
That's funny. Yeah, no, I mean, I think the whole question is how does the country move away from the current state of polarization and come up with some kind of a broader umbrella agreement. And that is what this coalition is trying to do, to focus not on the Arab-Israeli situation for now, but come up with a broader coalition on infrastructure and economic reform. And if they can do it, if they can shift the country away from the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian larger regional question and do something else for a while, they can build a larger coalition that then definitely excludes Netanyahu, and the next election might bring a broader consensus around modernization and infrastructure issues and economic issues that then strengthens the country to actually go back to an Israeli-Palestinian conversation. But right now, what we have is no focus on that. Instead, it is an emphasis on broadening, you know, consensus in the country that doesn't end with a fifth election that basically splits the country's population in half in this election. So it's an attempt to overcome the current blockage and polarization with a new approach, which was really needed, something new. I'm not sure it will work, but it's worth a shot, I think.
Alan?
Facts is facts. You know, Vera, you make a lot of very good points, and I think you're right about what might happen now. However, I do think that the reason that the polling has been 50-50 in Israel for so long is that there are an awful lot of people who are just scared to death about, you know, what the Arabs could do to them and what their Arab enemies could do to them. And so that while you're right about infrastructure and all the rest, we may move forward. That hasn't been the agenda item that has been holding things up. Now, my feeling is if they can move ahead, if they can prove, as you suggest, that we don't need him in order to not be scared, that will make the big difference. I think it really is as old as the country is, that that's where the schism occurs.
So, Alan, I would suggest that actually politics of fear are used by power mongers to stop any new kinds of thinking and conversation in the country.
Right.
I think Israel should be nervous about Iran, perhaps, less so about what's happening among the regional Arab countries. It has to, however, agree to, address the Palestinian question and especially also the rights of Palestinian Arab Israeli citizens who are not treated as equal. And the once you occupy an area like Gaza, you are responsible what happens there. And so it's a lot of these kinds of questions need to be addressed in an environment where simple talk of fear and potential horror erase all other fact-based information that is processed in the country. So I think that has to shift. And I think the attempt is to shift that a bit to a new kind of conversation where you actually look at what the facts are on the ground for all people who are, you know, in an extremely difficult position in the region.
I don't think we disagree.
I don't think we do.
Mm-hmm. I don't think we disagree. However, I know that the way that this has gone up until now has been this fear. And I think we agree on that. And that fear has manifested itself largely over, you know, Gaza and the Israeli people, tunnels and all the rest. But you're right. Once Netanyahu is gone from the scene, I think we have a whole, as you put it, a whole new conversation.
What do you think about this? And I'm not sure. I think what the premise is accurate. I'm not sure what the result would be. But Israel is no longer the little tiny country trying to defend itself from invaders from all different directions. It is now the big guy in that region, save for Iran. It's got the most sophisticated weapons. It's proven what's the technology? Is it the Star Wars technology? What is it that blocks the
The Iron Dome.
The Iron Dome.
Yep.
So that they're now the big guy on the block.
Yeah, they're the bully. They're perceived to be the bully in the area, right?
And increasingly so around the world.
Yep.
So to the extent that diminishes the support they have around the world, that another issue for them have to deal with.
Oh, you know, Ira, I don't know how much support they've always had around the world. You look at the United Nations at what goes on there over Israel. You can make any argument you want, but I don't think they have enjoyed a huge support from other countries, because it just doesn't work that way.
Well, they certainly have huge support from this country, which
right.
and
oh yeah, that's the whole story.
And I wonder, particularly, I mean, the analogy was made someplace a couple of weeks ago that people my age, boomers, I was born 2 months after Israel was born, but have historically felt a connection to Israel because of the Holocaust and all the rest, but that younger people, the millennials and on down, don't have that historic connection, have more of a sense to call out an Israel for being mm-hmm. a bully, and to the extent that this country has fully supported Israel, I would venture to guess that that support, though significant, is not nearly as much as it used to
and
be.
And I have to agree with you, Ira. I've noticed in the last year a marked shift in the conversation of Jewish American young people.
Yeah.
And they are quite critical about what has been happening. And they seem to pay close attention at the argument that, you know, the foundation of Israel was a long time ago, and now Israel carries the burden of treating all people in the region, and especially under its control, with dignity and respect and human rights. Mm-hmm. And that is a fundamental question for young people of Jewish descent and others in this country. Mm-hmm. A matter of conversations in many synagogues, from what I understand, yep.
That's all true.
If I could just jump in here really quickly, because to that point about millennials and how they think, you know, I don't think that there's a disconnect or that connection of the historical context is not there. I think more so what we see in this country and in other places is that is not the ruling issue of the day. It is acknowledging that context, but understanding we live in a very different world today. And so with that, we have to focus on people and issues, and not just our religious or our values tied to historical context. So, you know, I would not go as far as saying that connection is lost. I think it's just a difference in how that connection influences this push for power and policies, and what those policies need to prioritize.
And I think Dorsey makes a really good point. I think Black Lives Matter movements have informed and changed some of the general thinking about how central human rights questions should be, how a powerful state should not use its police to engage in very aggressive and violent techniques towards a select group of members of society. Those kinds of questions are in the minds of many young people in this country, across Europe, and in Israel. So this is the kind of, you know, change, social consciousness that is emerging, that shapes thinking and reshapes perceptions worldwide towards what's happening. And I think the attempt is to reposition the government in Israel to go back to the coalition formation. And we don't think that we can have a coalition of the far right and the far left. But the idea is to reposition, dislodge the current status quo from this government, dislodge the power play of the day, and create something new that might allow perhaps the Biden administration to also re-engage with the region and find a way to discuss and a way forward, rather than being stuck in this violent dynamic that we have in the region.
Before we go to a break, Alan, I know you yielded earlier. Do you want to make a point before we go to break?
Only that, look, I don't disagree with anything anybody's saying here, but I do think it's important to remember that Hamas has still said we got to force Israel into the sea. So it isn't as one-sided as if anybody's listening to this, they think that it is. I just want to remind everybody that it takes two to tango.
And I want to say Hamas does not represent all Arabs or Palestinians, for that matter, right? So I'm just saying Hamas is a violent group. It's a violent group, right? Hamas is a violent group, but it's...
It is, but they're also the ruling group in Gaza.
Yes, but they're occupied. Remember, Gaza is an occupied territory, and Israel has the responsibility. See, the thing about Netanyahu is he wanted Hamas to be like Hamas is today because he needed an enemy to strengthen his position. Now he wants something else, or he wants to, you know, play that game. The problem is that game is up. A new game, something new has to be created, and I think
Hamas
that's the problem.
How did Hamas get into power?
Well, when you surround a people and give it very few opportunities, the most violent branch of a political party will always gain power. We have example after example of that. If you just look at how, for example, the Turkish government has treated, you know, Kurdish populations, then you know why the PKK emerged, right? People want to defend their own. And, you know, I'm not defending Hamas. They're a violent terrorist group, and they certainly don't seem to care much about the suffering of their own people. But the fact that these dynamics exist where these power players, you know, go after each other and don't care about human lives in their own areas and don't look forward to, you know, don't try to identify a path towards peace. That is my problem. They're stuck in a way, and they both need to be dislodged.
So we are desperately late for break. So let's go to that break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this.
Down on the waterfront,
good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Dorcia Pleers, and Ira Fussfeld with us on the program this morning, having a good conversation this morning, and we welcome you to be a part of it. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So let's go to
By the way, go ahead. Netanyahu will be back in power in August. Wait a minute. No, that's Trump.
different guy.
Get those two confused.
Different guy. We had this problem. A couple of things. We had this problem earlier in the week when we were talking about millennials. Gen X, born 1969 to 1980. There is a group between boomers and millennials. We exist. So there is that.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
You tell them, Dorcy. Excellent. And once before, like I was 67. I'm not considered a boomer, am I?
45 to 60, I thought was the boomers. Is that
That's what I thought. All right.
So, Joe, what are we?
I don't know.
We're the in-betweens?
Yeah, I got to find that out. Alan,
what's 1941 again?
Don't take this personally, but I would say old. and I say that because I'm creeping up behind you, and I designate myself as old.
You'll never catch up.
No, I won't.
Okay. Let's see. Reacting to your discussions in Israel this morning, my concern says Israel is that the lack of historic knowledge and perspective of the Middle East on the part of the millennials proves to be a danger. Again, we're going to the the naming of a group here. The current struggles within the Israeli government for effective leadership further proves that Israel is a democracy in action. And remember that Israel pulled out of Gaza in 2005, paving the way for Hamas to take hold. Anyone on that? All right. Boomers in huge numbers have deserted Judaism and membership in synagogues in huge numbers because of the emphasis on Israel rather than spirituality. We also support a two-state policy. A number of boomers have adopted other forms of worship, such as Buddhism, calling themselves Jubis. Am I right on that? Okay. Too many Israel bond drives and not enough spirituality. All right, hearing nothing, I'm going to keep reading. And then Eliza says, as a mother of four young adults who was raised in an observant Jewish household, my kids see the plight of the Palestinians as much like the Black Lives Matter struggle. It's a race issue. The right-wing Netanyahu-like Israel's white Europeans are terrorizing brown Palestinians, demolishing their homes and subjugating them to apartheid-like situations in the West Bank. Gaza is widely reported to be the largest prison in the world, and that from Eliza. All right, let's move on. Oh, okay, so you're a boomer if you were born through 1964, according to this letter writer. Kevin says the same thing. 46 to 64 is the time that you're a boomer. But that doesn't ask the question of what you are after that.
That's right.
Well,
we're in no man's land.
Wasn't there a Gen X or a Gen
Z? Yeah, Gen X, but then she was saying 69 was Gen X. Oh. Another listener said 69, so I didn't know where you come in between 64. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
All right. We'll find out by the end. Alan and I know this much. People will write in about this.
People write in on, you know, anything. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong, but that's what we love about letters to the program.
All right. So a lot of people are writing about the baby boomers. So, yes, we understand. 46 to 64. So the next question up for bids is, what if you're born between, like, 64 to when millennials start, when does that come into play? Like, what is that generation? That was the question.
65 to, what is it, 70?
I don't know. We have to find out. All right. 65 to 80 is Gen X, says Michael Bowen, our engineer and research assistant this morning. So 65 to what, 80? To 1980 is Gen X. Oh, to 79 or 80, yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Gen X. Finally, we know who we are.
Thank you very much. You're the best. Okay. Greetings. Let us come to an agreement. The United States is an arms dealer. Why would we want peace? We sell weapons. Make all the religious claims you want. Israel will take Gaza, the West Bank, tear down the mosque and build a temple, and then maybe another religion will take it away again. So we sell weapons. Sales are good. Worry about getting a virus or your children not being able to go outside, or don't worry, be happy.
So
well, that's
one,
a lot there.
One of the things I have to say that I agree with is the whole arms deal question. A lot of Western European countries and the United States export weapons to keep their own corporations happy, to keep unemployment rates low, and not thinking about future consequences. This is a huge problem in many societies, and I think that is one of the other issues that this current generation will need to address.
All right. Then I think that is all we have on the letters. So let's go to another. Well, let's take a break, actually. We'll take a break and then we'll go to another topic and more letters here this morning. We welcome your letters, as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We just ask that you make them short and to the point. Punctuation is great. Verbs always help. You know, things like that. Pre-read them before you send them so we understand what you're trying to say and the point that you're made. And obviously, one per customer. Did I get all the rules in, Alan? I think I did.
That's a lot of rules, but they're good ones.
Yeah, they just makes things easier. So,
no parking in a fire zone.
That's right. or screaming fire at a crowded movie house or whatever. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. Alan Shartok, Dorsey of Pleers, Ira Fussfeld, Vera Carius-Kelly. It's easy to remember everybody's name when you can actually see them. We welcome you to join the conversation, panel@wamc.org. First, we have some business to attend to, and then news with the one and only Ray Graff after this. Stuttering, holding down.
Good morning.
morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A delight to have you with us. Joining us on the panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Dorsey of Pleers, Ira Fussfeld, and Vera Acarius-Kelly. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We touched on this yesterday, and there was a pretty good article expanding on the discussion we had in the Washington Post about Vice President Harris taking on the challenge of working on voting rights and what that challenge is and what she is up against. In early May, Vice President Harris sat down with members of several civil rights groups, including the NAACP, Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights to discuss what they saw as an assault on the right to vote in America. The meeting came amid rumblings by many in the civil rights community that Biden and his administration weren't doing enough to thwart what activists fear could become the greatest disenfranchisement since Reconstruction. According to an aide who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal deliberations, Harris emerged from that meeting with a request for Biden: "Let me spearhead the administration's battle against Republican voting restrictions." Now, nearly a month later, during an event marking the centennial of the Tulsa race massacre, Biden formally announced Harris's new portfolio on voting rights, placing the vice president squarely in the middle of a pitched partisan battle being fought at multiple levels of government. Alan, say you?
I certainly love Harris's attitude on this. Let me handle it. Look, everybody knows she's the heir apparent. If something happens to Biden, she's the president. If Biden serves one term and then goes out, you know, she's going to be the candidate, most probably. Now, look, she's saying, I want to prove myself. And I agree. Now, we got a letter yesterday from somebody who said, oh, well, she's a woman and you're just setting her up to fail. That's nonsense. If she's going to be the president of the United States, she's going to be the president. And, you know, she has every time now, this is a wonderful opportunity for her to prove herself. Now, I think the voting thing, she has an even chance on. I think the border is going to be a lot tougher for her. You know, I'm a big admirer of hers, and I think she'll make it.
Go ahead. Dorsey, your thoughts.
Yeah, so, you know, Reverend Al Sharpton was quoted talking about how, you know, she is the ideal person for this role in this moment in time. She is the face of voter suppression. First black woman in this position. So looking at her, one, being of African descent, but also a woman. And so I maybe understand where the listener who wrote in about this issue was coming from, because we know that this is a battle issue of the day. Historically, it has been the issue, voting rights, and it is layered with our nation's history of racism and practices to keep black people, women, from voting. And so these are the toughest issues to deal with, to address in this nation. And so as a black woman, some may say this issue is just that complicated, that difficult. People don't see us reaching middle ground on this, and so it's setting her up for failure. That being said, what I feel strongly is that she is the best person for the job. It is no secret that Biden is not the person that will motivate the different constituencies that need to be at play here in order to effectively address this issue. And so those constituencies that helped with flipping states, helped with flipping Georgia, I think Harris has that appeal to motivate and keep that base active and pounding the pavement. And I think they recognize that this fight has to be taken to the people. We can't trust Republicans who are fighting for power and play and position to do the right thing when it comes to voting rights. But what we need to do is continue to motivate people on the ground who help to change what democracy looks like, and Harris is the person who can do that, not Biden. And so I agree that she is the best person for the job, and let's be clear, she's a fighter. And so she knows how to roll up her sleeves and get dirty when she needs to. So, you know, I'm looking forward to what comes out of this, but this, where the power really lies is the people and the grassroots efforts that's going to be required to move the needle.
Ira?
You know, it's I'm hesitant to describe an issue such as this as the most important issue of our time for the survival of this country, because you could come up with another list of 20 that could equally apply. Having said that, this is the most important issue of our time for the future of this country. The brazenness of the Republican politicians in a handful of states to suppress the vote has obviously one motivation, and that is to prevent people, and mostly people of color, from voting. And if they know if people of color come out and vote, that they are not going to be successful, they meaning the Republicans. So the importance of this issue is, it can't be fully adequately described. And I agree with Darcy. I think that Harris is not only capable, but then some. She has all of the qualities to push this and to bring it to the people, as Darcy said, which really needs to be done. And there needs to be motivation. Dorsey, I'm very sorry.
That's okay. That's all right.
It's okay.
She's away, and she yes, Ira can't see her name tag.
No, and I knew I've had to live with Ira for 72 years. But I look forward to meeting Dorsey in person. Anyway, it's just terribly important, and Harris, I believe, is the right person for this.
Vera?
Yeah, I'm in agreement, too. I think Dorsey's right. Harris is a coalition builder. She's tough-minded. She will be traveling up and down the states and connect with people and speak to the issues that she perfectly understands because of her history, her parents, her heritage, and her experiences. So I have full confidence that she will be the ideal vice president to address this issue. Tough it is, but not impossible.
And Dorsey, let's go back to you for a second as to what Ira was saying of being the most important issue of our time. I mean, it's hard to argue with that, because what we're seeing is really an erosion and a rollback of things that took centuries and decades, if not centuries, to open up and make voting system better, not perfect by a long shot, but at least better. And here we realize the fragility of that, of how easily we can screw it up.
Yeah, and I would say that it is the most important issue, because it is the foundation for every other issue. You know, who is in leadership roles and positions dictate the decisions that govern everything about how we interact as people, what access we have in our neighborhoods, how our neighborhoods look and feel. So it is the number one issue. And so, again, this is just another attempt at trying to suppress the votes of people who tend, when you give them the opportunity, you make voting accessible, to vote for Democrats. And so Republicans know this, and so they're doing everything in their power to keep this constituency from voting, and in particular voting them out of office. So I feel that this is the number one issue. And then also, when you look at how voting suppression relates to marginalizing groups, people's freedom, dignity, rights, this is the core number one issue for a lot of people in this country. And I agree with that. It is the number one issue for me as well.
Joe?
Yeah.
I wanted to say something else. We have watched Joe Biden now. He comes out to the lectern, and his vice president is standing there. Her hands are folded, and she doesn't usually say anything. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but I didn't like it. I really felt, okay, I get it. That's what they're doing. She's standing there. Nevertheless, this is a golden opportunity to make sure that people's perceptions of her are as a doer rather than as a watcher.
Well, I wouldn't think that Biden views her standing behind him as a negative. I mean, he did the same thing. He was in that very spot when Obama was president and he was vice president. I think he believes it shows that they are a team. And now that he is assigning her, or she's volunteering for these important issues, I see her very much as an activist vice president. And in this administration, I think that's a good thing.
But there's a difference, right, Ira, from what you're saying, from standing there and not having these portfolios and now volunteering for them and having them.
Yeah, right? I agree with Alan in the sense that it does seem weird when she's there and has this wealth of knowledge to also have her come up and talk about these issues so the American people and we hear what is going on, and let her make the case. I know there are separate addresses that she does, but it does seem like, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Alan, but it seems like she's missing. I agree with you. I think they're missing a golden opportunity, right, to put her front and center on these issues.
Yeah. Except yes. She is the vice.
Dorsey.
If I may, I think that they're playing their roles very well. Some say when blacks and women talk about issues that tend to be issues that historically have been, for example, in this case, voter suppression, here they go complaining again. Of course, this would be her issue. Of course, she would have so much to say. I think her track record on this issue speaks for itself. She has been very vocal even when she was running for president. She has not been in the corner shy about this issue. I think what many want to see, progressive people who are really fighting for voting rights, they want to be clear where Biden stands. And will he use his bully pulpit to support Harris and this push for voting rights? And so I think it was important for him to be very clear, come out on the issue, and be very plain about where he stands and that he is putting the power in Harris's hand to push this work forward. And so for me, that is how I saw that play out. The question is not whether she can fight for this issue, where she stands on this issue. I think it's very clear. Can she effectively speak to the issue? Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think what many want to see is, Biden, how are you using this platform? And many of those constituencies put him in office. So we want to hear from you.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Yeah, that's a great point. Alan, so what does Biden do in that case, do you think?
No, I think Biden is the president. I think he's out front on virtually everything. And I think that she is standing with him and by him. And I think that's great. I also think that this clearly you have to get inside Biden's mind to say, why is he doing it? He's doing it because he's aware of the perception that she needs. If she's going to succeed him, she needs to have all of these platforms. And I couldn't agree more that these are excellent platforms for her to be on.
All right, let's move on to another issue, and I'm going to check the mailbag here real quick and see where we are on that. We go to Susan, who says, this may be a dumb question, but how is our VP going to alter this situation other than exhorting people to vote for Democrats? What happened to the John Lewis Voting Rights Act? Is that even in play? It's a great question.
Well, it's in play, but it won't pass in the Senate the way things are going.
Let's see.
We who did not like Trump were motivated like we had never been motivated before to get him out of office. And many of us mistakenly thought that once he was out of office, things would calm down and we'd seen the last of him and his ilk. Well, it's obviously not been the case. And so Harris, zeroing in on her, since that's what we were talking about, she has the ability, the talent, the bully pulpit to motivate people again. And you say, listen, we worked very hard to get this president elected and this vice president elected. Well, now we have to continue to work hard. Don't sit back. And that kind of motivational message throughout the country is what's going to be needed. Otherwise, all that we have feared would come back will in fact come back.
And I think it's so interesting because she's a woman, right? She speaks to so many women of color in all these different states that are paying very close attention to how she will handle these kinds of questions and who she builds a coalition with and how she encourages women to be strong and stand up for their rights and push back against this Republican Party that doesn't seem to want to concentrate on convincing people of an agenda, but just tries to exclude voters from participating in up and coming elections. So I think it's incredibly important that this agenda is spearheaded, and by a woman of color speaking to other women all across the United States.
But let's face it, as a black woman in this role is going to have a lot tougher time than a white man will. And she will succeed in addressing the constituency that you would think she would succeed. Unfortunately, in this country, there may be people who are on the borderline who would say, I'm suspicious of this woman, or I'm suspicious of this black person, or I'm suspicious of this black woman.
Maybe that's why it's important that President Biden also spoke on this issue, that we now know exactly where he stands and that he and Vice President Harris are one unit and they are pursuing the same goals. And that's why I think it was essential for him to speak and then her to actually do all the groundwork that will be coming now.
Dorsey, we've been talking about this issue all week in one form or another on the show about voting rights as it's gone through its various machinations. And what I'm interested in, one of the things that we have come to, is that, look, we talk about what's happening in Texas. We talk about what's happening in Georgia and in Arizona. And there are obvious great concerns of states. But here we are in very blue New York State, in very blue Albany. And look, that's not the gold standard for voting, right? So as a city official and I guess as someone who is in this community, of how you look at how we can take care of the problems that we have in our own backyard.
And so the question is, Joe?
The question is, what can we do? I mean, first of all, do you agree with the premise of the question that there are issues that need very fundamental issues as far as voting and equality in voting? And if so, how do we do those on a level? Because, again, we keep on saying, we look at it as a problem of, well, this is, a southern state problem. But we obviously have our own issues here.
Oh, absolutely. So is there fundamentally an issue? Yes. Yes, there is and has always been, and especially in the context of equality. We had great voter turnout throughout the state, in the city of Albany, throughout the country. More people voted in this election than, to my understanding, any other election in our nation's history, and that is, too, in the midst of the pandemic. So people came out for a reason, and I think a lot of that reason has to do with people being sick and tired of status quo when it comes to issues regarding race, inequity. And so that was one of the driving forces that brought people out who traditionally do not come out to vote. And so what we have to continue to do is expand the voting base. There are so many people who choose for their own personal reasons to not participate in our democracy, whether it is no matter what I say or do, my views will never be reflected in government. People in leadership just never see me. So why should I even take the time to go vote? And so people have chosen to sit out for a variety of reasons. And so we have to continue to do what we did with this last election, and that is focus on the issues that matter to people, make sure we have candidates running who inspire people. And that's the other thing that I think elected officials and others fail to realize. When you give people something to come out for, like with President Obama, people come out. And so, you know, the candidate is very important. The issues are very important. And, you know, in order for people to feel energized and empowered to come out, those factors matter.
Are there specific voting laws that need to be changed or tightened in the state of New York, in your opinion?
I think New York, across the board, yes. Just in general, we have some of the most antiquated voting laws. And so, you know, there were a lot of there was laws passed to reform voting in the state. And so while I think we are ahead compared to other parts of our country, there's always work that can be done, for sure.
Is there any state in the union that allows online voting? Is that it's time has come. It's the security of doing business online has been established. I mean, people do their banking and all their other
your taxes for goodness sake.
Yeah, I mean, I know the answer why, but I'm wondering whether there are any states that are actually doing it yet. I don't believe so. Alan,
no.
Do you know?
Don't know, sorry.
Okay. No, I'm not aware of any online voting.
Well, I'm surprised it doesn't get more traction.
But I mean, you know,
we're
going
to take care of gambling first, and then we'll figure out how to vote.
I won money on the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah.
So
but you know, the question to me is always, as somebody who's from another country, right? Why is it that, for example, we have voting on a day when many people work or go to work,
sure,
right? Why is it not, let's say, on a Sunday or on a holiday, or why don't we make voting a holiday, right? I mean, these are the kinds of questions that are so basic.
Well, Dorsey rightly asked, you know, so Joe, what is your question? And I guess what I didn't articulate in the asking of the question is that when you see what is being changed in states like Texas and in Georgia, where they are restricting 24/7 voting, and you think to yourself, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have 24/7 voting here in New York State? Mm. Oh, wouldn't it be nice to have the drop boxes? Oh, wouldn't it be nice to have voting, even if it's early voting? We still have to, you know, in some cases, you have to drive to your county center, which can be 30, 40 miles away. So when you look at some of these restrictions that are coming through, you think, oh well, these things that they're taking away are things we don't even have in New York State.
Remembering Joe, of course, that we have a Democratic state, we have a Democratic governor,
right,
who have overwhelmingly veto-proof Assembly and Senate, and yet you always have to remember that all those Democrats that we have got here under the old system.
Right, and they want to protect that system.
That's right.
Certainly.
I learned that from Alan. Okay, so we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. When we come back, we'll have our last go-around with our terrific panel, Alan Chartok, Dorsey Appleers, Ira Fussfeld, and Vera Akarius-Kelly. We will continue our conversation and include your letters after this short break.
No new songs to sing.
Song. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. Hard to believe it's Thursday. These weeks that don't have Mondays go very quickly. So we welcome you, and you certainly can be a part of our program, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Donald Trump shut down his blog.
Oh, no.
I know. This is upsetting you all. But here's the part that I just thought was that I got a tickle out of he was very frustrated by its low readership, and instead of allowing it to flounder, he just pulled the plug on it altogether and said, no, thank you. Still banned from Twitter and Facebook and struggling to find a way to influence news coverage since leaving office, Mr. Trump decided on Wednesday to shutter his do-it-yourself alternative, a blog that he has started just a month ago called From the Desk of Donald J. Trump. Mr. Trump had become frustrated after hearing from friends that the site was getting very little traffic and making him look small and irrelevant, according to a person familiar with his thinking. So let me go to the political scientist in the room and say,
Where?
I found one.
That's Vera.
So, well, I'll ask it both, but let me begin with you, sir, which is the fact that it is interesting that he is becoming people aren't reading what he has to say. People say he's becoming small and irrelevant. And then you look at the stranglehold that he has in the Republican Party, everybody shaking in fear. So how do those things hand in hand?
Look, Joe, the guy's got a 30-something percent, low 30s approval rating. He got elected because a whole bunch of people said, well, we don't like politics, we don't like government, we don't like this, so we'll try something a little different. He'll shake them up like he does on his television show. Well, he gets elected, and it doesn't work. His numbers go down. He never got over 50%, approval rating. And now, of course, it's hopeless for him. So now you see his people saying over and over again, we have to take it. We can't have these rigged elections. We have to take it, and he'll be in office even if he's not elected. And that is Hitlerian, and it is very, very scary. So he's searching desperately, because once the fickle finger of fame hits you, you don't want to give it up.
Right.
So he's searching desperately for a way to do it, and he can't find it. It's that easy. And over to you, Vera.
Okay. Well, I was thinking that in a blog, you actually have to make a consistent argument, and there has to be a flow in what you say for people to be interested in what you say. But that's not Trump's strength. His strength
is... And I don't mean to be a wise guy, but that you could say the same thing about, well, that was what you would look for in a president.
Well, yes. You know, I wasn't going to go there. But my main point was, he was a performer, a TV performer, sort of like, you know, his apprentice show. Short clips, quick messaging,
writers.
Background images, writers give you the line, right? That's what he's good at, being provocative, angry, speaking to a certain subgroup of the voters. Now, he still seems to have them motivated to go after, or I think that's why Republicans are still predominantly fearful of him. If he holds a speech and sort of motivates some angry Trump supporter to go after Republicans, but he does not have and never did have the ability to make a consistent, convincing argument on a blog. So that's just not his medium.
Well, but why he could do all of those strengths that you cited that he did on Twitter, he could do that on a blog. Why
no, it's
write
too long. A blog is too long.
Well, traditionally a blog is too long, mm-hmm. but there's no reason why he can't do a series of one-liners or even one.
Yeah, but people are interested in reading those one-liners. They want him to shout them. They want him to look half crazed. They want him to pound his fist on the desk or whatever it is.
Yeah, but I believe mm-hmm. that I know the reason why it yep. didn't fly. But putting that aside, why can't he do exactly what he did on Twitter on a blog? He could invent whatever he wants.
Do whatever he wants, yeah.
Now, I would say the reason is it's harder to find the blog. People don't want to keep – people are
Absolutely.
On Twitter anyway,
yep.
and they're looking all day uh-huh. at Twitter. And the blog requires more keystrokes to get into. But I do think if he followed his Twitter format on the blog and it got enough buzz, he might have attracted a larger audience.
Dorsey?
You know, I was thinking to myself, God forbid, Trump feels small and irrelevant.
Yeah.
And so, fake you news. Know, there's no surprise like that he shut this blog down. But as the conversation was playing out, I too question, you know, is his base one that would follow the blogs? I don't have the knowledge to answer that question, because it may very well be the main platforms that his constituency, his base, really focused on, he currently doesn't have access. And, you know, I thought it was almost comical to me. The lead-in for the blog was, at a time of silence and lies, a beacon of freedom arises. And I just thought, oh, my gosh, like this is this really.
I read that and then my head exploded, quite frankly.
So they're trying really hard any avenue that they can, and it's not working. That being said, I do still feel that we can't underestimate his influence and power. I think it's just that this particular platform is not working for him.
So we go from that story, which, again, I think is – and then you wonder what will happen, you know, what will come next. And I guess sort of Facebook and Twitter are still question marks,
wasn't
right?
Wasn't he going to start a TV show?
Well, there were all sorts
or
of rumors.
Network.
But,
a network.
You know, if he – go back to what I said before. If he did his Twitter format on the blog and it was very interesting and very provocative, would not it have been rebroadcast and printed in all of the media.
Yeah, but it never is interesting.
Well, but not by my definition.
No, it's not interesting. He says the same things. But
my point is, I think the mainstream media, to use a term I'm not crazy about, has largely ignored him because they feel he's just spouting off, whereas they would not have ignored him as a president.
Well, and don't we all have enough people in our lives that we go to their social media platforms and they're just, you know, bitching and complaining? I mean, like, do we need another one to look at that's complaining about something?
Unfortunately, this guy's different.
I know. Okay, so let's...
For whatever it's worth, we had a letter, I'd love to do it, asking that we memorialize the ex-police chief of Lee, Massachusetts, Jeff Roussa. I believe he had ALS, and... was widely appreciated by everybody in the Berkshires and particularly in Lee. So I just wanted to get that in.
Thank you very much. Certainly wish the family and send our condolences. We have a few moments left, and I would like to this story not only is just a fascinating story. We don't often do sports stories, but I think this goes beyond that, and that is the fact that Churchill Downs has suspended Bob Baffert, the embattled trainer of Medina Spirit, for 2 years. So what if you are at all up on this story, and if you're not, here's the quick summation, which is that Bob Baffert, the controversial trainer, had a horse by the name of Medina Spirit who won the Kentucky Derby. And the horse was maybe not considered to be the likeliest of winners of that race, but won the race. Then they came out and said, after the horse won, that there was a test that proved positive for a betamethasone, which is a steroid. So then they said, well, we're going to do another more complete test, and we'll see how it goes. Now, pending that, the New York State Racing Commission, NYRA, New York Racing Association, said, all right, well, we're done with Bob Baffert. We're not going to let him bring his horses into New York. We're not going to let him race in the Belmont Stakes, at least until this matter gets sorted out. So yesterday, that second sample comes back and shows that this anti-inflammatory drug was indeed present. So now Churchill Downs suspended Baffert for 2 years, which is a really, I mean, if you consider the three major, well, there are many, but if you think of the racing hubs as Churchill Downs, Santa Anita, and Belmont and Saratoga, and Gulfstream in Florida. I mean, if you start taking those off the list, if you can't race there anymore, that's a big hit to,
yeah,
to your
business.
It's
not just him. They banned his entire barn.
Whole barn, yeah. And all the horses and the whole team. So now they're saying, so the big question that remains is, will the folks in Kentucky and Churchill Downs say, we are going to remove and disqualify Medina Spirit as the winner of the Kentucky Derby and then give the top prize to the horse that came in second? And that is still to be determined. Ira,
well, say you? And if in fact they do that, reverse the Kentucky Derby, it will not impact the bettors. So
correct.
If you bet on the horse that won, as it did I, I'm not going to have to give back what money I made. On the other hand, the people from the horse who finished second will be quote unquote cheated out of getting their what would have been a win. I think there are a number of pieces to this, and I think one of the things that strikes me is that horse racing in this country is an ad hoc institution. It does not have an overall commissioner. There's the Belmont could do one, the NYRA can do one thing, and in California they can do something else. It's historically been an industry with shady characters, as are many industries, and I think it could use some reform. But those of us who are expecting to see Bob Baffert with his shock of white hair and the sunglasses strolling down Broadway in Saratoga Springs this year will not do not have to look for him.
Vera?
So I wanted to quickly say, I think when you said horse racing, it has a lot of shady characters. I think horse racing is cruel because it involves so much doping and it needs to be regulated. I personally prefer not to see so many horses falling, breaking legs, and being shot.
Put down.
Put down. I mean, that's what we do. We shoot them on the track, right? It also endangers the riders. It's a very dangerous sport. It's cruel to the horses. And I think regulation is overdue.
And you wonder if something like this will help that, although...
You know, Santa Anita, which, as you pointed out, is one of the centerpieces of the industry, about a year and a half ago had a very, very, very serious problem with the horses dying on the track. In fact, they closed the meet for a while and they tried to figure out what was going on.
Do an investigation.
And they're back in business. I don't believe that the death rate is as significant as it once was. But what I thought was interesting is that they did some comparisons to the death rates at Santa Anita and other racetracks, and even our great Saratoga racetrack had the same problem, although not necessarily the same volume. Philosophically, Vera's point is well taken. I'm not sure that it's ever going to kill the sport because enough people are interested in it and spend a lot of money on it. But I was at Saratoga the year that Steve Cawthon, the jockey's career essentially ended because the horse he was on fell in the stretch and broke his leg. Mm-hmm. Was killed on the track, and Cawthon never recovered. He was the greatest jockey of his time. Yeah. So it impacts people and the people in the business differently.
Well, and obviously, and this really shouldn't have anything to do with it, but it will have a lot to do with it, which is, of course, you know, what we learned last year is that it has a tremendous influence on the economy of this region.
Absolutely.
And especially upstate. So, all right, we're out of time. My thanks to everybody for being here.
I have to go to OTB. So.
That's right.
No, I'm only kidding. I can do it online now.
But you can't vote online.
No, I can't vote online.
Alan, thank you very much. A great pleasure.
You too, Joe.
All right. Thank you also to Dorsey and Vera and Ira. I thank you all. We'll be
Wonderful
back right
panel.
After this.
Thank you, Joe.